Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Cultivation of Bodhicitta, Aspiration Bodhicitta, and Action Bodhicitta by Eric Weinberg, based on chapters 9, 10, and 11 of The Jewel Ornament of Liberation by Jay Gampopa. Buddha taught that enlightenment is impossible without bodhicitta. When we explore the ways we have to help ourselves and others, nothing compares to bodhicitta. According to Shantideva, it is the supreme ambrosia that overcomes the sovereignty of death. It is the inexhaustible treasure that eliminates all the poverty of the world. It is the supreme medicine that quells the world's disease. It is the tree that shelters all beings wandering and tired on the path of conditioned existence. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to Columbus KTC's Sunday morning Dharma Talk. I'm Eric Weinberg, and I'm going to be talking today about bodhicitta, specifically chapters 9, 8, 9, and 10 from Gampopa's Jewel Ornament of Liberation. We were doing this series before, and I gave a talk on these chapters before, but I didn't touch the record button, and we're trying to be able to provide a complete set. And so when my turn to give a Dharma talk came up, I asked Lam Kathy if it would be a good idea to revisit this. And she thought that was a good idea. So this is being recorded now, and it'll be included in our set of teachings on the Jewel Ornament. And it turns out that this is like a linchpin teaching. It's a critical teaching to the whole path to enlightenment. These are the teachings that Gampopa gave on bodhicitta. And as Trungpa Rinpoche, who originally gave the teachings that wound up in this book, said, that the essence of this bodhicitta state of mind is the union of compassion and understanding, or intelligence. The only thing that can be said about relative and ultimate level is that it's not just a wish. Rather, it's the very cause for accomplishing enlightenment. It's not simply wanting enlightenment, but it's creating the cause for enlightenment. And that's why I say that it's the linchpin for the whole path. If you're on the path of the Dharma, if you're practicing the teachings of the Buddha, the reason that anyone would do such a thing is because they want to achieve what the Buddha talked about, which was liberation from the cycle of suffering. The beautiful thing about the Buddha's teaching is that he said it's an inside job. It's something that can't be bestowed on us by something outside. We can do it ourselves. And everything that followed really was method for being able to do it. That's the beauty and the generosity of the teachings of the Buddha. So to begin this teaching, let's begin the way that we traditionally begin, in taking refuge in the Buddha, the enlightened being that is our teacher. And the enlightened beings that are actually all around us, that are part of the nature of every single sentient being. And of course, the enlightened being that's within us, and that we're on this path towards uncovering. So we take refuge in the Buddha. outer, inner, and even most inner. Then we take refuge in the Dharma, those teachings that guide us along the way. And we take refuge in the community of people that are on that path with us, the great teachers that have realized it and share with us and encourage us and support us in our own path, and also ordinary people like us, companions, and the way that we support each other. So I'll chant it once in Tibetan, and if you know it, please follow along. If you don't, just follow along in your heart, understanding that Buddha is in you. You already have that which you seek. And it's also in others that are all around. And it's especially present and apparent in teachers that have realized and fully traversed this path. Sanje Chudang Sukhya Chunam La Chang Chu Partu Dagni Kyapsu Chi Daki Jin Sukhi Pe Sunam Ki Dro La Pin Shir Sanje Drupar Sho. I'll do it two more times. Sanje Chudong Sokhi Choknam La Jang Chu Pardu Dakni Kyap Su Chi Daki Jin Sokhi Pe Sunam Ki Rola Pen Shir Sanje Drupar Sho. Sanje Chudong Sokhi Choknam La Chang Chu Pardu Dagni Kyap Su Chi Dagi Jin Sogi Pe Sunam Ki Drola Pin Shir Sanje Drupar Sho. So, this path that we all aspire to, or maybe are just interested in, the cause for accomplishing this path, for accomplishing the goal of this path, is this thing called bodhicitta. So, what's bodhicitta? It's said to have two aspects. An ultimate aspect and a relative aspect. And when Gampopa presents this, he does it actually in a number of different ways. We won't be able to cover all the different ways that he introduces this. So I've just chosen parts of this. And I've also chosen, he uses similes, 22 of them. And that in itself would be enough for more than one talk. But I've chosen some stories to illustrate some of the points that I just have stumbled across along the way. So as we go through each point, I'm going to try to offer a quote or an illustrative story. So first, he talks about ultimate bodhicitta, which is really interesting because, you know, you would think that you would start with what is simpler and what's more like where we are right now. But rather than do that, he presents the ultimate first. The ultimate is the ultimate view. And the reason that he does that, I think, is that it gives us kind of a way to be discerning about how we're going down this path. So if we have this ultimate view in mind, if we always remember the view, we can actually sort of see how our behavior in the relative world is and whether it's our behavior is aimed at that ultimate view or aimed somewhere else. And this is really important. As Thay Sithu says, this is just the tension between what the Buddha called samsara, which is cyclic existence going around in circles, and nirvana, which is what Thay Sithu calls going straight. The interesting thing about going around in circles is, which is our normal relative world experience until we achieve realization. The thing is that we can make our circles bigger and bigger, but as long as they're still circles, we always still wind up in the same place. I don't know about you, but I know I've experienced this. It seems like, oh, here we are again. How many times has that happened? Even when I'm in the middle of like doing something, oh, that seems like it's bigger or grander or more illuminated and more selfless, and yet, boom, there I am. That's what he's talking about. So it's possible, even with the best of intentions, to go around in circles and continue to wind up in the same place. However, by going straight, you go from one place to another. It's very helpful to know where we're going. So I want to indicate that with a quote. And maybe a couple of quotes. The first quote I'm going to offer is from the third Bartle Tulku Rinpoche, who just demonstrated his wisdom mind mixing inseparably with the Dharma Dhatu. He passed away just over a week ago. He is a great teacher in the Karmakaju tradition and the Nyingma tradition. He said, samsara is just emptiness experienced by a mind that is in the state of delusion. Nirvana is just emptiness experienced by a mind that is free of delusion. It's really important to understand that what is, and our way of responding to what is what the Dharma works on. The Dharma has various practices, including bodhicitta, that help us to let go of our delusions so that we can be free of them, so that our reality, if you will, isn't going in circles anymore, but is going straight. And the place it's going straight to, this is the bodhicitta part, the ultimate bodhicitta part, is Buddhahood. We are all Buddhas to be. And the motivation for Buddhahood isn't just so that we can get out of jail free or something like that, but is so that we can help all beings get out of this imprisonment, this cycle of existence that keeps bringing us back to the same place again and again and again. Shanti Deva said, it's the supreme ambrosia that overcomes the sovereignty of death. It's the inexhaustible treasure that eliminates all the poverty of the world. It's the supreme medicine that quells the world's disease. It's the tree that shelters all beings, wandering and tired, on the path of conditioned existence. So, with that in mind, we can start to reflect on, okay, what is this exactly? What is this understanding, the understanding at least that I can have right now, right this minute, that will help me discern my steps along the path? So that's called emptiness, this view of emptiness. And the thing about emptiness is, we need to ask ourselves, empty of what? As Buddhists, we throw around that word all the time. And generally, we don't actually have a good working understanding of it. But the Buddha was very clear about this. What the Buddha taught was that what's empty, the essence of it, is we're empty of this self that we think we are. That's an interesting thing. So this really becomes, selfishness becomes the, the chains that bind us to the wheel of samsara as it turns, no matter how small or how big. And this letting go of this illusory self becomes the path to freedom. In Buddhism, we talk, in Buddhist psychology, we talk about various levels of mind or consciousness. For this example, I'm going to talk about the eight levels. And it's good to have this as a framework to understand this idea of emptiness. So the first five levels are simple. They're the five senses. Pretty much everything we think about and everything we know about comes through our five senses. And we, you know, experience a beautiful day. We see it, smell it, hear it. If we're hearing the wind blows, we may see a rainbow, maybe a horrible day, whatever. We say, yeah, that's the day I'm in. That's reality. And we kind of leave it at that. Then there's the consciousness that sort of receives all the impressions and puts them in order and tells us what our reality is all about. And that's the sixth consciousness, which is consciousness itself. Then there's a layer underneath that. Some psychologists, Buddhist psychologists, call it the substrate consciousness. And that's where all your habits and your karmas and everything are stored. You know, it's the storehouse of all the collected experience and reaction formations that you've gathered in this life and maybe over many lifetimes. And so you see the day that you have and you think it's wonderful. And then somebody down the street thinks it's a little too warm and they're a little uncomfortable. And so they're experiencing the same day, but their reaction, their habit of responding to those kind of conditions colors what's defined as reality in a different way that you do. That's where the seventh layer comes in. And it's not, it's in consciousness, in the sixth consciousness, we kind of collect it, order it, interpret it, tell ourselves stories about it. And then underneath that, those stories that we tell ourselves about what we experience in reality, well, those stories are all conditioned by, you know, our memories and our previous experiences and our limitations and our aptitudes, all of that. But it's still very conditioned. What meditation does, and this is important, is it helps us to let go of this sense data that's coming in, and then let go of the story we're telling ourselves about the data that's coming in, And then ultimately, we realize those stories are coming up because of habitual tendencies and other really subtle forces that get lumped into the notions of what karma is. And we realize that, and we begin to learn to drop those too. And when you drop through those habitual tendencies of interpreting your present moment, you are just in your present moment, in bare awareness, open and free. And when you're open and free like that, and you realize that all of this touches everyone and everything, and that you are connected to everyone and everything, what you think, do, and say matters. What dawns is this notion of interdependence. And it's in this notion of interdependence that you're not just this thing here with skin and bones and all of that. That's just a habit to identify as this discrete unit. But what you are is actually much, much, much beyond that. You're a whole mandala of connections that go out to the other side of the universe, really. When you realize that, you begin to care for all those little pieces and parts that make up your mandala, that make up your world. And you start to make decisions that help you be at home in your world and allow your world to be at home in you. So realizing that you are this being beyond the boundaries of the skin and bones, this voice, these senses, these thoughts about all of what those senses bring to us. Once you realize that, Zen people call that big mind. Once you're in a state of big mind, that's the ultimate. That's the ultimate. And of course, since you realize interdependence, you care about all the pieces and parts. And how we do that and gaining the skills to be able to do that well is relative bodhicitta. That's me waxing poetic a little bit about all of that. But I wanted to, you know, share at least my own personal view of relative and ultimate. So, you know, none of this can happen. I mean, it literally says, see if I can find the quote from Trungpa Rinpoche. The ultimate aspect of bodhicitta is the realization of emptiness, which also possesses compassion as its very essence. When the ultimate essence of things is clearly manifest, at that point, nothing fades away and vanishes. It is the time when we are free from all impurities and when our qualities and realization are completely developed. At that point, the understanding of emptiness automatically brings with it a great feeling of compassion. One cannot be present without the other. The ultimate aspect has to do with clear realization of what is ultimately true. And that's what I meant by using that view, that understanding of who you are as a point of discernment. And after discussing ultimate bodhicitta a little bit, Gampopa goes on to talk about relative bodhicitta. He says, the relative level of bodhicitta describes the willingness to accomplish Buddhahood for the sake of all other beings, and is based upon the based upon and inspired by compassion. We wish to become Buddha in order to help all beings reach the same state. Okay, that all sounds pretty good. So the next thing he does is he talks about acquiring bodhicitta. He says the ultimate aspect of bodhicitta is acquired in a very subtle way. We cannot have ultimate bodhicitta within us by taking a vow or by any form of external action. It is something that comes through meditation, through the understanding that comes in meditation. It is something that comes by means of the ultimate essence of everything becoming manifest for us. I want to describe for you a couple points of shamatha meditation that I think are important, because that's the great gift that we've been taught. Shamatha meditation, and we've been introduced to Vipassana and meditation, which is like the shamatha creates the space for us to see things without this delusion, maybe even just for a moment. And then Vipassana meditation is a form of meditation that helps us gain insight within that space. So it's sort of the union of space and light, just like the sky, like a clear sky on a sunny day. And that clear sky on a sunny day is sort of a simile for the kind of meditative state within which this bodhicitta, that's the cause of enlightenment, arises. A friend of mine, a Dharma friend of mine, has written about meditation, that as mental objects arise, and these mental objects are anything, sensations, thoughts, emotions, and so on, we don't engage with them. We don't appropriate them. And we don't fuse with them. That is, I think he means identify with them. We remain in a metacognitive state of bare awareness. Moment by moment, our mental objects continue to manifest, abide, and dissipate in the naked beauty of pristine awareness. Object by object, we continue to strip away those empty ornaments of mind in order to remain one-pointed in this naked awareness. Surprisingly, when we experience the emptiness of our mental objects, in other words, you can be really happy or really angry or really whatever. Let's take an emotion, for instance. If you don't engage with it and tell yourself a story about it, in other words, keep it going, you'll see that it came, and you'll see that it stays with you for a while, but then you'll also see that it dissipates, just like a cloud in the sky or a rainbow. And that's the emptiness of the mental objects. They're not solid and real in the way that we think they are. In meditation, we can experience that directly. So we're not left in a numb state of blank voidness. The co-emergent unity of consciousness and its emanations is still there. We have only stripped away the illusion of duality and the reification of self and other. The more we cultivate this insight, the less we get trapped in the discursive flow of samsaric mind. This bare awareness reveals the elegant nature of wisdom, compassion, and power that is inherent in our deep levels of consciousness if we just don't dress it up with ego. So how does that work? Well, the first teaching of the Buddha was, of course, the Four Noble Truths. And he said that the cause of suffering, the cause of samsara, is craving and clinging. So I like to consider craving as, I crave things that I don't have that I really want. And, you know, that could be a pleasant experience, a great meal. It could be anything. And I just, you know, try to get that for myself. Or I crave the peace and the distance from things that are unpleasant and things that I don't want. But I'm reacting all day long to whatever life brings me as being what I want or what I don't want, what my preferences are. That's craving. And of course, you can see that's lodged in my mental habits. It's not lodged in reality itself. The things that come and go, come and go. I identify them the way I identify them, and other people might identify the same thing another way. They're empty of the qualities that I project on them. So in a sense, the Buddha says, this projecting our preferences is craving. It's the cause of suffering. And also, right upon that, what happens is then we do the clinging part. The clinging part is just the story we tell ourselves about it. It's like, okay, we have a big reaction. Okay, we all do that. I just love this, or I just hate that, or I'm going to do this because, and then we tell ourselves a story. And in a way, that story, you know, becomes part of our story, and it does what Buddhist psychologists call reification. And it just keeps this illusion going. We've got this whole story about it now. And the reason I can't do this or want to do that or don't want to do this or don't want to, it's all story. In meditation, what we find out is we have the power to drop a thought. We have a power to drop the story. And when we're able to do that, we can catch a glimpse of this space within which all these experiences and stories arise, right? And it's in that space that we experience whatever is in a way that's free of our delusions, and we get a taste of realization. Usually doesn't last long, at least doesn't last long for me, but by meditating every day, my mind begins to get used to it. And by getting used to it, then these spaces of being free of delusion last a little longer and a little longer. That's why in Tibetan, the word used for meditation, there is no word for meditation, oddly enough, in this culture that this language that was built around spiritual practice. The word is gom, which means getting used to. And that's what we're doing. So these exercises that we use to acquire bodhicitta, which really are meditation, the forms of meditation of shamatha and vipassana, are there to help us get used to what the nature of our mind really is. So Gampopa wants us to be able, right from the start, to be able to catch a glimpse of the essence of our own minds. And he doesn't shy away. He doesn't say, oh, you can't do that yet. You have to do this, this, and this first. He encourages us to understand that so that we can begin to learn to discriminate, to understand that, there's a thought, there's an emotion, and to get used to the fact that we have the power to let it go, so that within that power and within that space, insight can arise. And within that insight, we can begin to do the right thing in the right way at the right time to the right people. And that's action bodhicitta. That's relative bodhicitta. And so there are some skills that go with that. He says the relative aspect of bodhicitta is different than the ultimate that is developed in this subtle way. It's not, relative bodhicitta is not acquired through meditation. That's interesting. He said, we acquire it through external symbols. We acquire it through our spiritual friend in the form of a commitment on our part. He says it'll require some effort to develop it. So there's this thing called the bodhicitta vow. And for those who are interested in this path, that is a wonderful thing to begin with, to start to take the first steps on the path of developing the qualities and the activities of relative bodhicitta, which is really qualities and activities. It's how we are in the world. So we try to keep developing that state of mind, that ultimate state of mind, to prevent it from degrading. But then we begin to learn to practice compassion. We take some vows. We vow to do certain things and not do other things. And it's really, really the whole thing of relative bodhicitta is based on the four immeasurable thoughts and the six paramitas. So I'll run through those briefly so that you can see how it fits in. So the four immeasurable thoughts, you've heard a lot. In the Theravadan tradition, they're called the four Brahma Viharas. They were taught by the Buddha. And he said, he taught them in the form of a prayer. And the prayer is, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. That first one, that one, is also identified with loving kindness. And loving kindness is directly identified with wisdom. So if you think of wisdom as a conceptual, abstract term, in this worldview, it's not conceptual or abstract. It's loving kindness. It's loving kindness that extends to every sentient being without exception. So already you can see that you're cutting through that preference thing simply by really taking that first Brahma Vihara to heart. It doesn't matter whether your reaction formation tells you to love or hate somebody. I mean, you might not know what to do. You might not know how to be kind in a real constructive way, you know, in a non, say, codependent way, for instance. You may not know yet. That's part of the developmental phase of relative bodhicitta. There are things we got to learn, but the aspiration is to be kind to all beings without exception. And the second Brahma Vihara is, may all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And that means all beings without exception. And so once again, we're looking at, you know, getting past the way that we limit reality as it comes to us, and we have this wish for being free from suffering. Being free from suffering, or freeing others from suffering, is the working definition for compassion. So you have wisdom and compassion. The Buddha taught that when you unite wisdom and compassion, you have the experience and the expression of enlightenment. Well, in order to remove suffering, it's even more challenging in a way. To do that skillfully takes, you know, skill. And it takes learning some stuff about how to do that. It takes learning how to communicate. It may take learning something about first aid or medicine if people are hurt. It may be learning how to teach meditation. I teach meditation in the prisons, in a sense. That's both kind and compassionate, because people experience something, even in that those circumstances, that's within them that can't be affected by the iron bars that surround them. And they experience freedom. There's loving kindness in sharing meditation with them. Also, because they learn they can let go of a thought, and it's their thoughts that wound them up in jail, following their thoughts, literally this wanting something that they didn't have and then telling themselves a story about it and following that story till its logical conclusion, which in their case wound up in jail. So when I teach them something about letting go of craving and clinging, they find that they have the power and the freedom, no matter their circumstances, to work with what they've got and to not go around in circles and make the same mistake over again. But it's up to them to do the work. Beyond sharing the knowledge with them, you know, I can't do much. But that's the way compassion is. We have to learn something called skillful means. So that's compassion. Then the third one is, may all beings have perfect joy. And perfect joy is that you're connected to the light within you, this enlightened entity, this enlightened self being, that is really you, this Buddha that is really you, so that no matter the circumstances, your joy is unaffected. Just like throwing something filthy through the air. Well, it goes through the air, but it doesn't affect the air. The air is still what it is. It opens up and lets it through, and then whatever it is you threw falls to the ground and the air comes back together, seamless and still pure. That's what perfect joy is like. Is Pema Chodron says, we are the sky. Everything else is just the weather. And that's sort of the attitude of perfect joy, even if things are going horribly wrong. It doesn't affect at all this Buddha nature that's within you. And then the last Brahma Vihara is, may all beings have profound equanimity, not holding some close and others distant. In other words, we don't get into the, you know, this get lost in the stories about our preferences so much. And by not being lost in these stories about not having what we want and having what we don't want and so on and so forth, we come to peace. We realize that we actually are at home in this universe, and this universe is at home in us. And that's the kind of peace that is unshakable. So when we talk about those four immeasurables, we're talking about the unshakability of kindness, compassion, joy, and peace. So that's the aspiration. And then there's the action part. And the action part is really just the six paramitas. The six paramitas are generosity is first. They go in the order of the ease with which we can accomplish them. And yet they're all interdependent. One contains all of them, and all of them are contained in each other. So the first one's generosity, and it obviously frees us from the delusion of selfishness. And it frees us from the delusions that come from pride, you know, preferring one thing that we'll keep for ourselves and give the lesser thing away and all that kind of story we tell ourselves. So by practicing generosity again and again, we begin to retrain our mind and go against the kind of sandbox thinking that, you know, this is my toy, I want it, you can't have it, and that's your toy, and so on and so forth. Generosity transforms that way of being in the world and helps to dissipate the delusion that clouds our minds, that is pride and selfishness. The next thing is ethics. Look, when you know that you're connected to everything and everything is connected to you, what else can you have or want besides ethics? You want to treat everybody well, and you want to know how to do it. And you want everybody to treat you well, and you want them to know how to do it. And so we have this ethics. What the Buddha taught about ethics was you have to have that before you can even meditate. That's very interesting. Buddha taught that until we understand ethics and until we live in an ethical way, our minds will never settle down and our meditation will be fraught with difficulties. So when he taught three higher trainings, he taught that that meditation was the second higher training. The first higher training was ethics. So it's ethics, meditation, and wisdom. And that goes right along with these paramitas. So we train in ethics. And I won't go deeply into that right here. There's a lot written about it, and it's worth reading, and it's worth contemplating. So after ethics, you know, is patience. Because the truth of the matter is we do have a lot of reactions, and we do get angry. And the antidote for anger, or, you know, the discomfort that arises from having what we don't want and not having what we do want, the antidote for that is patience. And in patience, we learn something about impermanence. When we're patiently just looking from the point of view of meditation, we can see that things arise and fall, and that we can modify them in ways that are positive if we're spacious and patient, and we can modify them by kindness and compassion. So patience requires already generosity and requires ethics, and it begins to introduce us to the state of meditation, the motivation to be a meditator, because it's absolutely required in order to heal the delusion that is anger that's within us. So the next thing is joyful diligence. And joyful diligence comes because we see that this stuff is starting to work, and we cultivate that. We begin to rejoice not only in our good fortune of being on this path that's starting to go straight instead of go in circles, and it'll make you happy when you reflect on it at the end of the day. I promise you that. And that happiness, that joy, as you move further and further down the path, becomes more and more indestructible. And that joy leads to actually deeper insight and deeper learning and more practice. So the fifth one is called meditative stability. And that's what the Buddha was referring to when he said ethics, meditation, and wisdom. The meditation that he's referring to is called samadhi. And it was mentioned in that passage that I read to you as one-pointed meditation. You'll know it when you see it. But when you sit in shamatha and you finally achieve this state where you can place the mind and let it be unaltered, simply let it be, that's called samadhi. And it just takes practice. It takes getting used to. It takes gum. It takes familiarization. Yeah. And you realize that everything that appears and exists actually for you is arising as your own life energy, your own mental energy. Where else could it be, really? If your senses and your consciousness didn't bring it to you, what would it be? And at that point, your relationship to your own mind begins to change a lot. You begin to be kind to your own mind. Kindness isn't just outer directed now, but kindness is also coming to life within you and towards you. And that overflows as bodhicitta for all beings without exception. And that is the quality and activity of wisdom, which is the sixth paramita. That sixth paramita is the full realization of emptiness, that is empty of self and other. And so you get some kind of a experience of this non-dual quality of reality. So relative bodhicitta is developed within the context of ultimate bodhicitta, and is developed by making a commitment. It's good to make that commitment with a spiritual teacher, but you can actually do it as a prayer every day for yourself. And that's what most of us do. Some of us have received the vow from another, you know, from a teacher, some not. You can just have an image of the Buddha in front of you and say the words of the bodhicitta vow. Or you can have an image in your mind. Trungpa Rinpoche says that's all good. So it's something that we can all do. It's something that is the cause for us to achieve the goal. And the goal that we have. And therefore, it's beyond what I can speak about in terms of importance. It's why we take refuge and generate altruistic aspirations by chanting the four Brahma Viharas pretty much before every practice that we do. And it's the reason that we dedicate the merit of our practice after we've done it to all beings without exception. We're training our mind. An example of an enlightened mind, for me at least, that realizes this is Thich Nhat Hanh, who's not from Karmakaju tradition, but he's truly a world teacher. And I have a little story here that seems to reflect for me in a very down-to-earth way what this big mind is like. He said, "I asked the leaf whether it was frightened because it was autumn and the other leaves were falling. The leaf told me, 'No, during the whole spring and summer, I was completely alive. I worked hard to help nourish the tree, and now much of me is in the tree. I'm not limited by this form. I am also the whole tree. And when I go back to the soil, I will continue to nourish the tree. So I don't worry at all. As I leave this branch and float to the ground, I will wave to the tree and tell her, 'I will see you again very soon.' That day, there was a wind blowing, and after a while, I saw the leaf leave the branch and float down to the soil, dancing joyfully, because as it floated, it saw itself already there in the tree. It was so happy. I bowed my head, knowing that I have a lot to learn from the leaf." So I think I'd like to leave it there. And take a moment to dedicate the merit of having come together to consider, to think about, to meditate on, to contemplate this Dharma of kindness and compassion, and this Dharma of openness and ultimate reality. And I want to dedicate in this way. I want you to contemplate two phrases. Pour all the positive goodness and energy that we've accumulated together this morning into this thought. It is in your self-interest to find a way to be very tender. And allow your tenderness to simply flow out of you, out of your eyes, out of your pores. When you speak to somebody today, out of your mouth. When you think about things in your self-talk, find a way to be very tender. That's the right way to dedicate a time spent contemplating bodhicitta. And then remember and dedicate yourself to this, to turn soft and lovely anytime you have a chance. Turn soft and lovely. Allow your Buddha nature to shine forth. And allow it to recognize the Buddha nature in others and encourage it. Encourage it to manifest, to come out, to play. So thank you very much for joining us, Columbus KTC, for this Dharma Talk. As most of you know, we're rebuilding our Dharma Center, which was burned down by an arson fire. And we're raising contributions. We're raising money to try to help rebuild it and make it a vibrant Dharma Center for this whole region, and in fact, extending out to the whole world as much as possible. So your contribution, if you find it within yourself to make one, will be very valuable, and you'll join in this effort to benefit the whole world with these teachings and practices and much more. So you can find a donate button at www.columbusktc.org. So thank you very much, and we'll see you around the Restream studio on YouTube and Facebook, and hopefully by next autumn, when COVID lifts and the building is completed in our new Dharma Center. So have a wonderful rest of your Sunday. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.